And what I'm going to do is challenge the consensus view of how we should do ontology and how we should or maybe not do ontology, and really bring into question some of the assumptions that have been repeated over and over and over again. I was in the emergent session this morning. It was taken as a sort of background assumption that we have our ontological questions basically taken care of, that we're all physicalists, that we all want to be physicalists in some sense, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm going to attempt to raise a number of questions about physicalist consensus in contemporary philosophy. Physicalism has come under a great deal of pressure in recent years. Obviously in the 90s, there were standard criticisms of physicalism coming from most famously people like David Chalmers, who, and more recently even Kim, has rejected a sort of full-blown physicalism. Daniel Stoliar's recent book, just called Physicalism, raised a very beautiful, there's a beautiful challenge to the physicalist consensus in that book, where Stoliar says, well, they're either, physicalism is either false or trivial, not actually deserving of any substantial credence. Now, I'm going to take a step back from that and try to untangle some of the motivations for physicalism. So why would we want to be physicalists from what I will reject over the course of this talk. Okay, so the main points, and I'll try to get through this so we don't take too much time from lunch today. I'll be talking about what I think as the strongest version of physicalism. And this is Quine and Melnick's, recently Andrew Melnick's articulation of physicalism. So Melnick most recently has argued for what he calls realization physicalism. And in his 2003 book, A Physicalist Manifesto, I think he gives the strongest case for physicalism that we have at present. But I'm going to say to begin with that Melnick's view is vulnerable to fatal inconsistencies. So it simply can't be right. Nevertheless, I'm going to say that Quine, obviously it's a Quinean tradition, that Melnick and Quine are right to claim that ontology should be informed by inquiry and evidence. I'm not going to argue for that. I take it as given that physicalism is an a posteriori doctrine. It's a posteriori because things could have been otherwise. Right. There's nothing that's physically impossible in, let's say, a Cartesian world or a Leibnizian world or a Berkeleyan world. Right. So the claim that the world is physical is a claim that can't be, I argue, defended a priori. I won't defend that claim today, but I take it, physicalism, to be an a posteriori ontological claim. Okay, so the second thing I'm going to argue is that Lewis style, David Lewis's ideal case physicalism, as I'm calling it, is inevitably incomplete and ad hoc. So I'm going to argue that the more metaphysical version of physicalism that we find in Lewis fails in principle. And that's a strong claim, and I hope, and if you really need me to argue for that, I can do it. But I'm going to hold a lot of that argument till the end, or defer it to a paper that I've recently written. So I'm going to dodge that one a little bit. So the constructive part of the talk will be to say that, you know, determining what the ontology of the actual world is a matter of selecting from the space of what I'm going to call the extended nomologically possible worlds. So we've got nomologically possible worlds. Those are worlds that are law-like in our way. But we also have what I call the extended nomologically possible worlds. Those are possible worlds that cohere with the general principles of physics. So those would be worlds that obey some meta-principles of physical inquiry. So nomologically possible would be worlds that are like our world in terms of the laws governing those worlds. Extended nomologically possible worlds would be worlds, let's say, that have different laws, but different kinds of physicists, but are still within the purview of what we might call physics. Right? So they obey general principles that we adhere to in physics. Now what I'm going to say is that physics, well, we might say that, you might disagree with me, but I think for this I'm going to say that physics may be our best way of inquiring into nature, The physics itself doesn't tell us which metaphysical principles to accept. So really the issue will be to recast, and there's a very nice part of Stolier's book where he says, you know, physicalism was great in the late 20th century because it gave philosophers a job. And what was the job? The job was to reconcile our common sense intuitions about the world, about the mind, about morality, about aesthetics, etc., reconcile that with the physical. Right. So much of late 20th century philosophy was involved in that task of reconciling common sense with the physical. So physicalism gave philosophers a great, it was job security. Because the principle of physics can't do that job, right? Because physics is doing physics. And then the job of late 20th century philosophers was to reconcile physics with common sense. Now, of course, physics, as philosophers conceived of it, I'm going to say, was they weren't, this is what I'm going to call in this talk, philosopher's physics. Right? But actually nothing to do with physics, or very little to do with physics. And the kind of physics that philosophers thought certified the ontology was basically, the ontological questions were basically left to some other domain. So in a sense, physicalism allowed philosophers to avoid thinking about ontology. Ontology was basically taken care of by another agenda. Okay, so I'm going to shift that. I'm going to ask that we change the character of the job of philosophers so that it's not so much about reconciling physics with common sense, or a common sense version of the world, the sort of Solarzian project of the manifest and scientific image, but it's more that we become critically engaged with physics itself, or with the scientific inquiry itself. Okay, so what's physicalism? Very, very quickly, you can already see there's a lot of philosophy packed into the definition of physicalism. Physicalism is basically the claim that everything that exists, existence is a philosophical notion, is somehow determined, that kind of determination is a philosophical question, by, or is identical with, the physical. We don't know what the physical is. So we've got three big concepts here, all of which require philosophical interrogation. Okay, so physicalism as articulated was immediately shot at by Hempel back in the 60s, and Hempel provided us with a big challenge to physicalism. Hempel's dilemma, we now call it. So which physics provides the perfect ontology? That's the question. Is it physics of the past? We would say no. Physics of the past is false. Is it physics of the present? No, because present physics is false also. By induction, we know that that's probably wrong. Is it future physics? Well, the problem with future physics is we don't know what the content of future physics is. Future physics is unspecified. So it might turn out that David Chalmers is right, and we have some sort of, what do you call it, de-physicalism? Physicalism with qualia attached to it? We don't know what the content of future physics is. This was Hempel's dilemma. So he says, if you're a physicalist, and if you think that physics determines the ontology, which physics are you talking about? Not past physics, not future physics, not present physics, presumably because by induction it's false. So presumably it's something like ideal physics. So physicalists are committed to the ontology of ideal physics. The trouble with future physics, as Hempel articulates it, is its content is unspecified. Now, the people who accept present physics as determining the ontology would be, for example, following Quine's footsteps. So Quine, of course, as we'll see, argued that our ontology, our ontological commitments are set by our best current science. Melnick is the most sophisticated advocate for the contemporary version of this, and he's ready to say, yeah, I know that physics is false. But it's false in the same way that any other scientific theory is false. So the proponents of any scientific theory recognize that there are likely to be improvements in the theory. No one is claiming, in most scientific inquiries, that the theory is finished. Right? So that you, like any other scientist, Melnick says, I advocating, or I'm holding on to, or I'm committed to physicalism as a normal scientific hypothesis, like any other scientist. Okay. So he's ready to do that, and I'll talk about some of the problems with that. Other philosophers, so Janice Dowell, for example, or Jessica Wilson, are both arguing for a commitment to an ideal finished physics of some sort. So both Dowell and Wilson will talk a little bit about what case they make. So let's look at our options. So first, present physics determines our ontology, our quine. How does that work? Well, Quine asks, what is there? And he says, that's easy to answer, everything. So it's an easy question to formulate and an easier question to answer. This is Quine's famous joke, and no one laughed. Okay. So he says, what exists is what our best physics says exists, plus whatever our best physics needs to assume. So in Quine's case, set theory. Right? So it's physical objects plus set theory. And why does he say that? Well, we have evidence for the superiority of our current physics over previous versions. And the evidence there derives from standards of scientific evidence, just normal standards internal to the science. And we have evidence then for physicalism. And what's the evidence for physicalism? The evidence is history of science. Why? Because all of the competitors either ended up in degenerate research programs or were failures for various reasons. So our ontological commitments then, according to Quine and following him, Melnick, are pragmatically motivated. That's the most reasonable thing to be right now as a physicalist. All right, so here's the problem with saying that in this specific case, poor Melnick, in his beautiful book in 2003, here's the problem with his view. He argues that physicalism is false, fair enough, I accept that, he says, but in the unremarkable sense that most scientific theories are false. Right? Okay. Physicalism then is a scientific hypothesis like any other, and it deserves the same kind of credence that we would give to other winning scientific theories. So it's winning the game, it's winning the battle, etc., and let's give it the credence it's due. Jessica Wilson points out brilliantly in a footnote that is reporting email correspondence between her and Melnick, that, look, we know that general theory of relativity and the standard model are inconsistent, and that's a well-known point. I won't explain why, unless you want me to in question period. And if they're inconsistent, then quote-unquote physics contains a contradiction, and it's irrational to give credence to a contradiction. So it's just simply, it's not like any other theory. It's false. Physicalism must be false in a stronger sense than ordinary scientific hypotheses. And we'll return to that point later at that time. Now what I want to say is that I want to save some parts of the Quinean project. So I want to say, look, intuitively, Melnick and Quine are correct to place inquiry and evidence at the heart of ontological commitment. But I'm going to say they're wrong to accept that we must simply accept some total package called physics. Right? Now, they simply can't do that anyway because general relativity and quantum mechanics are incompatible. But fundamentally, it's because the reference of the term physics is not a single scientific theory. So it just doesn't work for Melnick's purposes. But I still want to hold on to this idea that inquiry is important in fixing our ontology. I mean, intuitively, that seems right to me. Okay, so what if you go with what Jessica Wilson and Janice Dowell say? Well, they argue, look, we should take a chance on the ideal physics, and the way we can do that in two ways. And they're both really interesting philosophers. Janice Dowell says, look, let's take the risk of the open ontology, and our bet is that it probably won't include mental entities. So it's a different kind of issue of probability and credence than Melnick. Dowell's committed to the future finished physics in this sense. Jessica Wilson doesn't take that tack at all. Instead, what she argues is, look, I'm I'm just not admitting the possibility of mental entities as foundational or as fundamental. Why am I not doing that? Well, this is the via negativa strategy for defining physicalism. Physicalism just is the rejection of mental properties. Simple as that. So it's a conceptual argument. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these two today, but I want to indicate that there are alternative strategies. Finally, someone could reject both forms of the dilemma, like Robbins and Ladyman or Alyssa Ney. Alyssa Ney says, no, we reject both sides. We're not determining physics by our ideal finished physics, or physicalism by our ideal finished physics either. They both advocate for this different view. It takes physicalism as something like an attitude. Alyssa Ney argues that physicalism is an attitude or a stance. And this is following, of course, on von Prazen's discussion of empiricism. So von Prazen famously argues that empiricism is not actually metaphysics, it's more like a stance. Okay, so now you might, so let's say we look at ideal physics, physicalism, and here we could replace ideal physics, physicalism with philosopher's physics. And so David Lewis famously articulates he focuses on the idea of the determination relation and describes how supervenience can account for the determination relation. So that would be a way of saying, look, I don't care about Hegel's dilemma, let's just focus on what it would look like if physics finished, etc., etc., if we had this ideal physics. And he famously does that via Humean supervenience. So Humean supervenience famously is, sorry about the wall of text, let's reduce that a bit, is the doctrine that what we have is a vast mosaic of local matters of particular fact. Here's the via negativa part, but it's no part of the thesis that the local matters are mental. That's parenthetical here, it's important though. So what we have is we have an arrangement of qualities, and that is all. There's no difference without difference in the arrangement of qualities. All else supervenes on that. So this is Lewis's account of how the ideal physics would finish, would determine how all the actual facts would be determined by the physical facts, plus this little clause right here. I'm not even sure that's a proper English sentence, but it looks like one. And that is all. Okay, so you've got the set of physical facts, the claim that and that is all, that alone will determine. Well, you might say, but are these really the physical facts, right? I mean, you could be a fundamentalist and have all kinds of ontological foundations. Well, Lewis thought they were the physical facts. He thought all of the local matters of particular fact were the physical facts. Just to prove that, you might say, oh, Lewis had an open view of what natural properties are, et cetera, et cetera. No, in fact, Lewis was clearly committed to physicalism. So what we have here, Lewis says, roughly speaking, materialism, and he writes, in brackets, equals physicalism, is the thesis that physics, something not too different from present-day physics, but presumably somewhat improved, is a comprehensive theory of the world, complete as well as correct. The world is as physics says it is, and here we go again, and there's no more to say. Okay? So this gives you the heart of this kind of Lewisian fundamentalist ideal physics, physicalism. Okay, so just to be completely redundant, here's the completeness claim. Physical facts plus the claim that and that's all there is gives us all the facts about the world. So more evidence that this is the case for physicalists, that completeness is central, is Papinow. I won't read that, but it basically says completeness is what's important. If the completeness is right, then there's no room left for anything non-physical to make a difference, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so what are the core commitments? One is the claim that the physical world is causally closed, and only the fundamental physical properties or entities make a causal difference. And that's all there is. Two, individuation involves unique causal powers, so if something's real, then it really does something, and it does something in a way that can't be reduced to whatever. So you have these two core commitments that are exemplified famously by Hegel's work in the late 90s and his defense of physicalism, really criticism of emergentism more properly. And that's the core view. Okay. Now what I'm going to say is that, and I've argued elsewhere, is that ideal case physicalism is incomplete. It's committed to what I'm calling an ad hoc restriction on possible ways that the world could be. So I'm going to call fundamentalist stories about possible ways the world could be books of the world. And I'm going to say that Lewis's physicalism blocks possible, plausible, scientifically respectable books of the world. And we have to learn take our implications from that. I'm not sure what the implications are, but I'm going to argue that the door then is always open a posteriori to properties that are not determined by fundamental slash ideal physics properties. And that's a claim that I won't argue for in detail. I'll talk a little bit about that today, but that's what I'm going to do. Okay, so let's think about these books of the world, these accounts of the fundamental level. So whatever your favorite metaphysics is, in some sense it should give you something like a book of the world. Fundamentalism in ontology then says that there will be a set of fundamental states of the world, and transformations on that set. I'm using the set theoretic language here deliberately, such that all states are either fundamental states, or they result from some transformation on that set of fundamental states. So this generalizes from physicalism. This looks a lot like the earlier account of physicalism, except now I'm talking about any fundamentalism. All right, so some books of the world we're going to say are better than others. Presumably we should be in a position to judge some as better than others. And how are we going to carve out the space of books of the world? Well, within the space of possible books of the world, we're free to carve out our regions based on some preferred constraint. So in physics, for example, you'll generally regard the physical conservation laws as ruling out certain kinds of transformations, and hence as ruling out certain kinds of books of the world. And other meta-principles will rule out other kinds of books. So simplicity, symmetry, blah, blah. Okay, so if we want to think about how constraints on the space of books of the world will look, let's first look at an unnecessarily restrictive constraint on possible books of the world. So you remember Nietzsche, the eternal recurrence of the self-same, etc. Well, we have something similar here. We're going to have, as our rule, a system is an acceptable physics if and only if it cycles through all the possible states of a system. Okay? So let's say we say it's not physics if it doesn't hit all of the possible states of the system. We'll call this the one cycle rule. So then given some n set of states of the system, possible states, here you've got four ways the universe can be. So given some n set of states, the set of books that you can have, the set of ways things could be, would be n minus 1 factorial. So in this case, there are four states in the system, six possible ways to cycle through all four states. There are six total one-cycle books. There's one, there's another, etc. There's all of them. Okay. I would say this is an unnecessarily conservative picture of the way the world would be. So here's a less conservative constraint on possible ways the world could be. So we'd say, well, look, there are some systems which obey conservation principles, let's say, and they contain some systems. So here we have four states of the universe, but there's like two subsystems. So our world goes 1 to 2, 1 to 2, etc. This arrow should go in the other direction, let's say. Goes 1 to 2, 2 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 1, 3 to 4, 4 to 3. And so you've got a world with two subsystems. And now you've got, if you include subsystems, which cohere with the law of conservation, then the number of transformations which preserve information is n factorial, where n is the number, instead of n minus 1 factorial, it's n factorial, where n is the number of states in the set. which is fine. So 4 by 4 times 24 different ways the world would be given that. Okay? So those are different ways of carving out the possible kinds of metaphysics and sort of candidate kinds of physics that that we might be interested in. In the case of, I mean, you get the idea. So I hope it's, yeah, we can keep going. So if you have three states, blah, 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 I'm going to skip that. All right. If you don't care about conservation principles, let's say you don't care. Well, then you've got n to the n possible ways the world can be. Right? You have no restrictions. So it just becomes a matter of the possible combinations. Okay. Now, if you don't care about conservation principles, let's say, which is, you know, it could be the case. I mean, conservation principles don't come to us from Mount Sinai, right? Okay, if you don't care, then you're going to have different kinds of ways the world could be. So there are transformations which result, for example, like this. A goes to A, B also goes to A, C goes to A, and D goes to A. So everything, pretty much, first step, goes to A. So you had four possible states. At time one, time two, you have one state remaining. Okay. Or AA, BC, CA, CB. But these two varieties, these two instances, are part of this larger variety of possible books of the world. These are cases among the vast majority of ways the world could be. So the vast majority of ways the world could be do not preserve information. They don't obey conservation principles. The vast majority of possible worlds do not obey conservation principles. The vast majority of cellular automata do not obey conservation principles. So if you have the, let's say, 256 Wolfram cellular automata, only 16 of them involve symmetry or preservation of states. That's striking. Okay, so, and these are what's called, if you don't preserve information, if you don't conserve, if you don't obey the conservation principles, then these systems are going to involve what are called transient states. And the idea of transient is very simple. Transient is a notion that comes from engineering, and you're familiar with it when you hear your fridge start, when your fridge kicks in. So let's say, for example, the thermostat on the fridge goes, and the thermostat tells the fridge, we've got to cool things down. When the fridge first kicks in, you've got this rumbling, right? Before it goes into its steady cycle, right? Depending on the quality of the engineering of your fridge, it'll be longer or shorter. That little point where the whole thing bounces around, that's the transient state before the fridge starts to cycle in its steady state, okay? So engineers were worried about reducing transients because they damage the equipment, right? When you first turn the thing on, it has to find its steady state. That transition to a steady state is damaging to the machinery. And so there was a big industry among engineers in the 1950s trying to eliminate transient states. So they became an object of study. We don't care about them today. Our electronics are robust enough to not worry about them too much. But they're interesting. So a system with transients would be one where, for example, you've got all of these things, and they all converge to a steady state, let's say at A. And then once they do, you can forget about the rest. Okay. So these conditions are not preserved in the transients. Now what's really important for philosophers to recognize is that transients can appear predictably. There's no mystery to transient states. They all obey, well, they can be understood as obeying mechanistic conditions, right? So they can all, bottom line, they're fully natural. There's nothing unnatural about a transient state. So Wunsche has this, he's a computer scientist, he works with cellular automata, has this discussion of possible states of, how am I doing for time, professor? No? He has a discussion of possible ways that the systems can evolve. And here what you see is, I'd have you look at this. So here's the state space. You have your computational system in some state B, and you know it's going to head into some set of states. How am I doing for time, Professor Loka? 10 minutes, okay. Has some set of states that it can converge into. It's following the rules of the cellular automaton, or whatever the computational model is. And what you can see is that there are alternative possible paths. That's the key. So in a computational model, you'll have a tree of possible paths. And usually, always, a computational model will converge to an attractor. And the attractor space can be represented within this. Here's the state space. Here's the drawing of the attractors. These are the alternative attractors that the computational model can converge to. And let's say you were in this. Let's say this modeled our universe. I'm cutting this too short and too bumper sticker, but that's okay. So here we are. Let's say you lived here. Okay. Let's say this is where we lived. And if you were a denizen of this little universe, you are going to cycle indefinitely by the rules of the model, on and on. Okay. Now, if you lived here, your complete physics would be described by this, right? Okay. You would know your past. You think you know your past. You know your present. You know your future, and you think you know your past. But what computer science tells us is, you know, in all these kinds of conditions, there are a variety of possible paths that. Pasts, rather, that could have led you to any of these attractor states. And those will be lost. That'll be information lost. Okay, those will be lost in a computational system. Now, again, to repeat, most mechanistic stories about the universe take this form. Right? And that's provable. Wolfram proved that. Okay, so we don't want that. If you're a Lilithian, you don't want that. You don't want a condition where you have transient states. And transient states, it turns out, arise because of interaction. I don't have time today to explain why that's the case. But you get a transient state when you have interaction. So a Lilithian has to block interaction or deny it. Say there is no interaction. There's no genuine interaction. So the Lilithian, of course, the target is emergent. They want to block the possibility of genuine emergent properties. And so for Lilithian, they're only apparent transients. And they're always going to be deemed explicable in terms of the mosaic that they're sequencing. So how are they going to block outbreaks of transients in the book of nature? Well, they're going to make all subnetworks fall into a single cycle so that there would be no genuine subsystems. So there's no possibility of genuine subsystems in any sense that would admit possible interaction. This will require us to rule out books with subsystems, even though they're in compliance with normal conservation principles and form large parts of the extended nomologically possible books of the world. Blocking past interactions means you're unable to account for differences in historical properties. So we shouldn't believe that physical facts plus that's all there is give us the actual, if we include the history of the actual world in A. And Lewis has no reason not to, by the way, because of, that's an argument. Therefore, in principle, we're going to say evidence won't support the fundamentalist completeness claim. That's an in-principle argument. If you include the history of the actual world in A, then you won't be able to support the fundamentalist completeness claim. Now, this gives some support to the intuitive arguments. So Louise Anthony has a beautiful argument against Kim from way back, from 99, where she says, look, you can't account for concepts with this. So you know what? I'm going to skip this. But it's a great argument. Basically, it has to do with your spouse and the aliens and the horses. All right, so what I'm arguing then is Lewisian physicalism is committed to a kind of ad hoc restriction on the books of the world. So it's not merely a commitment to conservation principles, which I think we can defend on empirical grounds, and the differences in historical properties can be given a naturalistic account. So the kinds of arguments that Louise Anthony and others made in the 90s aren't just intuition-driven arguments about the importance of historical properties. So it's not just that, you know, she's saying horse is a historical property essentially, therefore microphysical duplicate of a horse is not a horse. It's not just driven by intuition, the emphasis on historical properties. I would like to say more about that, but I can't. It's not just about philosophical thought experiment. You can give a naturalistic account of differences in historical properties. Okay, so let's say we reject ideal physics physicalism, which I hope I can convince you to do. You still want to maintain some commitment to the relationship between inquiry, I hope, and ontology. So what about some version of Melnick's, what I'm calling pragmatic physicalism, his realization physicalism? Well, as we saw in Melnick's case, it's just false. And we saw that Melnick was willing to bite the bullet and say, yes, I know it's false, but it's false like any other theory. It turns out it's not false like any other theory. It's false in a special way. But the trouble with this pragmatic physicalism and where Melnick ends up, I won't have our time to defend this, but I think it sheds no light on general ontological questions. So I think pragmatic physicalism sheds no light on general ontological questions. Okay, which is bad, if you care about ontology. So I would like to keep ontology open to inquiry. So what does that mean? Well, what I'm going to suggest is that determining the ontology of the actual world is a matter of selecting from the space of the extended nomologically possible on the basis of evidence, a posteriori. So discovering the nomologically possible, of course, involves tracking the entailments of meta-laws of nature, tracking what we're committed to with our meta-level principles. And that's a job for philosophers. That's not a job for physicists. So how do we eliminate irrelevant alternatives? So now what I'm going to say is we're not fixed on a particular ontology. We're going to eliminate ontologies. We're going to say what we're not doing. So here I'm adopting the spirit of the Stance model from Alyssa May. I'm adopting the kind of via negativa that Jessica Wilson has, but I'm doing it, I think, in a better way. So what do we say? We're eliminating irrelevant alternatives. We're going to eliminate the nomologically impossible. We're going to eliminate, of course, the false cases, the cases that are shown to be false through experimental evidence. So what's that going to look like? So here we go. So here's some. So we're going to say that some subset of possible worlds comport with your favorite meta principles. Now this is the hyper simplified version. So here we have our favorite meta-principles, whatever they are, and we're going to say that some kinds of ways the world could be comport with that. So what's our ontology? Our ontology is somewhere in here, the ontology of the actual world. Now we have, of course, two experiments, and then we eliminate some subset of the possible ways things could be according to the meta-level, the extended nomologically possible, and we get closer to the ontology of the actual world. And that would be the model for how evidence contributes to ontology. But of course, it's not so simple. It's not so simple because our candidate meta-principles need not be compatible. So it might be the case, we were discussing this recently, that conservation principles are not compatible with a commitment to a mechanism. It might be the case that, et cetera, et cetera. So pick any set of meta-principles for your science, it might be the case that they're incompatible. And this is obviously, it's a scientific question, it's also a philosophical question. I hope it's largely a philosophical question. So candidate meta-principles from the very start need not be compatible. So the issue is, I mean, we're going to have to get into the detail, not the details of science, not the details of the science, but the principles governing scientific inquiry. And the investigation of the possible is the job of philosophers. Okay, so here's the take-home lesson. The take-home lesson is that pragmatic kinds of physicalists have mistakenly felt committed to accepting the whole package, right? So they thought they had to accept as the physical, or the characterization of the physical, what physics tells us. The trouble is, this physics that they think exists doesn't exist, but that's a different story. So what I'm going to argue instead, and the ideal physics, I'm going to reject for other reasons, but that inquiry into the choice of metaprinciples is going to be the task of ontology in the 21st century. And I urge us not to be seduced by the philosopher's physics, the kind of physics that someone like David Lewis assumes exists. Especially this claim that, and that's all there is, which, of course, is the basic starting point for fundamentalist metaphysics. So thanks very much.
So I think the I'm wondering about cleaning up the world. I'm not sure I could accept that characterization. I think obviously we want to reduce the space of, so we want somehow to allow inquiry to help us settle on an ontology. I think that's, I don't argue for that. That's a sort of an intuition I have, is that, you know, evidence should help us decide what our ontology should be. In the case of the Wunderslide, the point there is that, let's say you're just committed to mechanism. If you're committed to just mechanism as your sort of guiding principle, that a satisfying explanation should be a mechanistic explanation. And let's say, for example, you're someone like Steve Wolfram. And Wolfram thinks, for example, that cellular automata can capture all of the facts, all of the ways things could be better than differential equations, right? So there's going to be discrete cases that differential equations will never capture, but cellular automata will, et cetera, et cetera. So he sees this as an incredibly powerful technique. Let's say you're like Wolfram. So Wolfram's physics is a computational physics. If you're Wolfram, then most of the ways the world could be contain transients, right? Contain these kinds of danglers that disappear, contain information loss, are irreversible, etc. So you've got irreversibility built into nature if you adopt a computational physics. Traditionally, physicists have not wanted that. They've wanted reversibility of laws. Right, at least at the, yeah. So they wanted the laws of physics to be reversible. So all I'm doing there is asking us to think about alternative meta principles. So if you're committed to reversibility, that's That's one set of commitments. If you're committed to mechanism, that's another set of commitments. And so they might be in conflict, or they might overlap in ways, etc., etc. If you're committed to both, then etc., etc. So it's the combination of those meta-principles that I'm interested in. And is it a cleaning up? Well, here's the thing. I don't think that the picture that physics gives us is a clean picture. Maybe that's the way to put it, right? So contemporary physics is divided, is a house divided, right? So you've got relativity and quantum mechanics. They're in conflict. Why are they in conflict? They're in conflict because general relativity is committed to every point in space-time having a determinate value, curvature. And quantum mechanics says we can't do that because if we have position, we don't have momentum. If we have momentum, we don't have position, etc., etc. Okay. So physics can't be the philosopher's physics. Right? Contemporary physics certainly doesn't fit the bill of the philosopher's physics. I mean, if you're serious about physics, you can't really be a Lewisian in the sense of Humean supervenience, right? So what mostly happened in the 20th century was people ignored what physics was actually doing and just had a placeholder that they called physicalism. And they, well, philosophers of mind, philosophers of biology, etc., metaphysicians. So physicalism was the way to take care of all those ontological questions. And they saw the job of philosophy, I think Stoller makes a good argument for this, they saw the job of philosophy as being reconciling that given physics, physicalism, philosopher's physics, with the common sense. Right? So our sense of selves, minds, morals, aesthetics. Yeah, so cleaning up, I don't know. I don't know. I guess that's a long answer. I just don't know. Yeah.
All right, thanks. Thanks for this talk. It was interesting. I didn't really get the main argument, and maybe that's just my fault, but it seemed to me that you just presented it in one or two slides, and I didn't see how the existence of transience impedes Lewis's Humean supervenience.
Oh, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to run that.
And also, I have a couple of other comments about information. So, you mentioned the word information, but it's not clear to me that information is something physical necessarily.
No, no, sure.
So,
sure.
And I don't know what role that plays in
theory. Sure. It's just a placeholder. Yeah, and it could be other conserved values.
Okay, but there are so many theories of information. Right?
I'm not sure. Sorry. You know what? I should just say conserved values.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about, I don't know, how much time do we have, Professor Kopecz?
5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes. How many questions are there?
You guys want to run through this?
Because I can refer you to the paper where, okay. But very simply, let's say you admit the possibility of these subsystems, and you have some set of rules governing the subsystems, but then you have interaction, whatever that means. And you have, let's say, you have rules for interaction, okay. Fair enough. All well and physical so far.
So what stands for one and what two?
Okay, so these would be like sub parts of your overall physics, right? So let's say these are, let's say, particular domains that are law governed in this way.
Supersystem.
Okay. So rules for how they would interact. And let's say this is your physics and you start to run. You have the rules for interaction, things light up, things change. We can go through this more slowly later if you'd like. Okay, so now, if you engage these rules of interaction with the network with these initial conditions, then this is the cycle that you end up with. You end up with a DZ cycle, and what happens here is that you never return to the AW, right? So that's a transition.
Something like the irreversibility of the Hamming thermodynamics, or like entropy leads to things like that, or because I think this is too abstract.
It's very abstract, but it has to be abstract. No, I'm not going to. Because I'm talking about meta principle.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So I can't go there.
But at least the instantiations of this in the physical.
I can't give you a physical instantiation.
Okay.
So I have to give you a computational structure. Yeah.
So I have to use something like a cellular automaton model of how this would happen.
But the point here is, just to run through it, is that what we end up with is the rules for the system as a whole here are given. And so now, once you have this set up, you'll never go back to the AWU, right? But here what you have are basically laws of physics. So this is like, remember the little circle where the people are living, the denizens of the cycle and the computational model converge? Back in the bunch slide? So, okay. This is not going to be feasible. But, okay, so here, remember, do you remember how we went into the system, we went into the state of the system?
Yeah.
Right. So, and let's say you live here. So you live here, and, you know, you have your physics, you have your story of how physics develops within this, right, attractor cycle. That's the same kind of thing here that's happening. So now you think, oh, we've got the whole story. We've got the whole story about our mini world, right? Except, of course, you don't, because this is how we got into this, right? So we got into this. And what's striking is, if you deny this, if you deny this sort of thing, if you deny that these are possible pasts, it's an impediment to scientific inquiry. Because let's say you did live in this world, then you'd never have any impulse to, let's say, interrupt this interaction and study these networks in isolation, which is what science does. It controls variables and isolates parts of systems and studies their behavior. But if you were committed to this, if you said, no, this is the story, because we've got the whole story here, if you excluded that possibility, the possibility of transience, you'd be excluding possible scientific investigation. So there's a practical problem. So now, what's striking, of course, it's a toy case. It's a, as you said, extremely abstract and resistant.
Yeah, but why the answer that this is the future physics will?
Oh, because future physics will never get this. Right. Right. Future physics, if you live in that cycle, you'll never have that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's so real, however, on your view. I mean,
it's real. Think about it this way. Think about the point when the galaxies have moved so far away from planet Earth that we think, and this will happen in 10 to the 20 years, we think, our robot children in the future, think that this galaxy is the entire universe. Right? Because in principle, because of the acceleration in cosmological terms, their night sky will be a lot darker than ours. They'll have no access to other galaxies. And they'll think that this is the way things are.
But if they do many measurements or many things, they will be
this is actually really interesting. So we can talk more about that. But there's a cosmological proof that the evidence will disappear. The evidence of the Big Bang will disappear in 10 to the 20 years. We're in a very special time in history where we have evidence of the Big Bang. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not just crazy talk, right?